think you're likely going to be okay. I mean, you know, when you think about a 1 in a million event, that's, you know, you cross the street every day, you have a much higher chance of getting run over by a car. So I think what people need to be is don't freak out. I would be living, going on in my life, but I would be very attuned to my body. And if I develop shortness of breath, if I develop leg pain, if I develop a headache, and I'm within 2 to 3 weeks of having had the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, I would immediately notify my healthcare provider.
Dr. Carlos Del Rio, Executive Associate Dean at Emory University School of Medicine, explaining why the public should not freak out over the federal government's decision this morning to pause the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Officials are looking into 6 cases where women who got the shot developed a serious and rare blood clot. They were between the ages of 18 and 48. The symptoms occurred within 2 weeks of getting the vaccine. One woman died. Another is in critical condition. Governor Gavin Newsom also announced today that California would temporarily stop using the J&J vaccine, though it only accounts for about 4% of the state's current supply. Still, it could mean a slowdown in getting people vaccinated, just as everyone age 16 and older is now eligible here in L.A. Joining us now is Dr. Monica Gandhi. She's an infectious disease doctor and professor of medicine at UCSF. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Well, 6 women suffered this blood clot. That's out of nearly 7 million people who have received the vaccine in the United States. Do you think this pause is an appropriate reaction?
You know, I think that it's a little overkill to pause, as opposed to what the EU did with a similar side effect with AstraZeneca, which is just for now restrict it to using among older people, just because this is such a rare side effect. And we really do need to look into these 6 women, like you said. Were they on other medications? Did they have any clotting disorders? And so it's really easy to characterize 6 people. So I would have probably said, okay, for now, let's just restrict it for 50 and older, maybe even men, while we're looking into this.
Although it's a little puzzling as to why younger women had these blood clots. They're between the ages of 18 and 48.
Yes. So some people have wondered about oral contraceptives, have wondered about women being more likely to clot, which is actually true in general. Women are more likely to clot because of simply estrogen. It's why actually oral contraceptives do increase the risk of clots among women. So that happened with the AstraZeneca as well, that it was the side effects of clots were more among women. So it is something to absolutely look into. But as Dr. Del Rio said at the beginning of your program, this is a very rare side effect. 1 in 1.1 million, essentially. You know, as you know, 12 in 100,000 people die in a car crash every year in the United States. So we want to be cautious, but not get panicked.
Right. And this is happening just as there was that manufacturing problem in Baltimore with Johnson & Johnson, and there was going to be a less supply to begin with this week. What does all of this mean for getting people vaccinated quickly?
You know, as you said, in California, actually, because of that manufacturing problem in the Baltimore, Maryland plant, 15 million doses had to be essentially wasted, which was really unfortunate. And because of that, this Johnson & Johnson vaccine wasn't going to be a significant proportion of our supply in California. So I don't know if it will change things that much in our state, at least maybe by a week or two, not much. It just is sort of a larger implication. Is what I'm worried about is people understandably getting worried about relative safety of vaccines. If we can't message appropriately that these are very, very rare side effects and that you can call your doctor, check in, ensure that you're doing okay. We could even decide later, and the ACIP is meeting tomorrow, to restrict this right now to older patients. And that please do not worry too much about vaccines. We have a big COVID pandemic going on, and we want to get people vaccinated and get through this pandemic.
Still, I can just see how this will inflame the argument on the part of anti-vaxxers that vaccines shouldn't be trusted.
Yes, you know, I think that's what worries me the most, only because just in general, if you are giving an intervention out to so many people, I mean, this is unprecedented, right? This is the largest mass vaccination campaign in history. It's sort of like suddenly giving everyone, showing them the sun. There is a lot of people getting these vaccines. Same with AstraZeneca. And the EU made a very adjudicated decision to continue with the rollout of the vaccine. So did Britain as well. And Britain's doing great right now with how fast they've gotten their vaccine out. Once you get cases low enough, we don't need everyone to vaccinate, but I don't want this to worry people who are already against vaccines that we're trying to do something that's unsafe. I think these vaccines in general are very safe and incredibly effective.
You mentioned Britain. Oh, one thing they did, and they're at around, I think, 40% of their population is vaccinated. One of the things they did was delay the second shot of the two-shot vaccines.
Yes.
Do you think that that should happen here, given the fact that we do have this problem with the one-shot J&J, and we want to get people vaccinated as quickly as possible? Would it be advisable for people to wait to get their second shot and use those shots for other people?
You know, I definitively think that we should change that strategy now, which is giving one shot and delaying the second shot. It's not saying don't give the second shot. It's saying delay. And I think there are for a number of reasons. One is that Britain showed us the way. They did this. They actually delayed by 12 weeks for their second shot. And now they're actually at 50% first dose given. You're right about second dose, but they're at 50% first dose given. They just opened up yesterday. Kids are back in school. People are feeling so happy there because they're getting through the pandemic because they made that decision. Second is vaccines aren't antibiotics. They don't cause what's a quote selective drug pressure to make you break through the vaccine. And we're just suggesting a little bit longer delay between first and second to get more of our population vaccinated. I think enough experts are calling for this. I think it would be a really, really smart thing to do now.
Well, right now it's what, 3 to 4 weeks between doses? How did that number
Correct.
Come about in the first place?
You know, it's important to know that there was no magic to that. Actually, that short duration of time, 3 weeks for Pfizer, 4 weeks for Moderna, was actually in the name of expediency, because the pharmaceutical companies were trying to give shots in as short as time as possible to get the results of their trials, to get the vaccines out into people's arms. So actually, there was no magic about that shorter time frame. And in fact, the AstraZeneca vaccine showed us that people who received their second dose at 12 weeks had more what's called immunogenicity, or more antibodies or an immune response at 12 weeks versus 9 weeks versus 6 weeks, meaning the longer you delay doses, the better they did in an AstraZeneca trial. This is true of vaccines in general. We always delay between shots. It actually gives us more of an immune response. And it's why a child, for example, you don't want to give them too early. And if they end up being a month or two late for their childhood vaccinations, no big deal. So this is known in the vaccine world that we are happy to delay shots. We don't want to give them too soon.
So why is the public messaging here the opposite of that? I mean, Dr. Anthony Fauci himself is saying that he doesn't recommend delaying the second shot.
You know, Dr. Fauci said just last week that it just would be a messaging problem at this point if we ended up changing it. And I actually think it's not really a messaging problem, because I think the American public understands that we do change our mind based on new data. And where's the new data coming from? We got to look at our friends in the UK. They chose this strategy. They're going much faster. All of their vaccines are two dose, because AstraZeneca is two dose, and so is Pfizer, and so is Moderna. And so they chose that one dose strategy. And I think it's changing your mind based on looking at great data and making that change to the American public. And I don't think that the American public will think that's a messaging problem. I think that we're used to things changing, like recommending masks later, for example, when we didn't recommend them at the beginning. I think we're used to getting more data and having things change.
Do you think that the federal officials are actually weighing this and that they will change the messaging?
Yes, I do. I actually think that they are weighing this with there was an article in the New York Times today with really a well done example of all the reasons to go to one dose. Dr. Stanley Plotkin is a really vaccine expert, wrote a clinical infectious disease article about this. And I do believe that both California and the federal government are considering this.
Well, thanks again for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Monica Gandhi, an infectious disease doctor and professor of medicine at UCSF. Coming up, a selective history fully illustrated of what we eat and why. A new book with such fun facts as how ancient Egyptians invented the marshmallow. The author is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brad. Well, if you are a fan of KCRW's weekly food show, Good Food, then you are probably familiar with the work of my next guest. Stacy Michelson is an illustrator based here in Los Angeles. A few years ago, she took it upon herself to illustrate every episode of Good Food for an entire year. Her food drawings are bright, they're colorful, they're tons of fun. Imagine an avocado that looks like it just came out from a workout, or a champagne flute with cool guy sunglasses. Well, now she has her own book full of her food illustrations. It's called Eat This Book, Knowledge to Feed Your Appetite and Inspire Your Next Meal. And it includes tons of tips and some fun facts about some of the world's favorite and sometimes misunderstood foods, such as, did you know the ancient Egyptians created marshmallows? Or, until the last decade, Pizza Hut was the biggest buyer of kale, or that mochi ice cream was created right here in Los Angeles. There are a lot more factoids like that crammed into this delightful book, and Stacy Michelson joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline Brand.
Well, it's just a page-turner. It's hard to rip my eyes away from the pages of this book. I just want to know, first, how did you learn how to draw like this? Did you go to art school?
I think I just draw like this. I studied a lot of art stuff. I went to a cool high school that had screen printing and photo. I went to art school for a little bit for film, so not quite illustration stuff, but I don't know. I think I like to take notes like this in this like sketch note style. And then I just like to draw fun cartoon stuff.
And so how did you decide, okay, I'm going to marry these two things. I'm going to marry my love of drawing and cartooning into with my love of food and create a book about it?
Well, I think that started with that whole Good Food project that you mentioned in 2017. Uh-huh. When I like illustrated that show. I think, you know, I'd worked in restaurants for a long time, and I was always the go-to person that would make, you know, the special signs or draw on the menu board or draw the kids menu. And I just thought, how do I do this as like a real job? Like, how do I get, you know, people to notice me to say, hey, illustrate my cookbook or something like that. So that's why I started doing that Good Food project, when I just gave myself that assignment, because I thought, you know, I'll start posting this on Instagram and it'll give me practice, but it'll also kind of show people like, hey, I think I can do this thing of, you know, having all this food knowledge, but then also the artistic skills to show you something maybe in a new way.
So what makes a good food drawing? Like, how do you know when you've really gotten it, conveyed the essence of the, let's say, pear or fig?
So like for this book, I think there's a couple parts. Like I do all the research, and then in my sketchbook, as I'm researching it, I'll circle something or I'll put something that I really think, you know, like in this whole book, there's a lot of talk bubbles. So those are things like in the way that I would just tell you if you were sitting next to me, like if you were there and I was like, oh, Madeline, look at this. And I would say, you know, I'd pull out a quote and I'd draw a talk bubble around it and kind of start forming my page like that. But then there has to be like a clever way to display the title. So like for Nopales, like I do that in the actual cactus to show the little cactus pears on the ends, like to write out that name. And then I think overall, just if at the end, I want to like take a picture of it and send it to some of my friends and be like, look at this drawing. Then I think, okay, I think that's a good drawing. I think that's good enough for the book. I can stop, right?
You actually grew up in a food family.
Correct.
Right? Your dad and grandpa were produce buyers and exporters?
Yeah. And so like I'm from Huntington Beach down in Orange County, but my grandparents lived in LA. My parents are from LA. And that was just, yeah, like the Michelson business. And so I always just knew, you know, all these fresh fruits and vegetables that my dad would bring home or that I'd have at my grandparents' house. And that was just, I don't know, that was totally normal to me. And a lot of my friends, I'd like give them something like a taste of something for the first time. I think, you know, they'd be like, hey, can your dad get me more of those caramel apple things? Or can you bring home artichokes or mangoes or, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, so that was, I mean, we weren't a restaurant family or anything, but I think being exposed to all the produce was really cool.
So you knew how to eat an artichoke and you knew how to cut a mango.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. The mango thing with, you know, you score it and then you flip it inside out like a little porcupine. Uh-huh. Like that was my favorite. So like in the book, I try to do a lot of little, you know, like stories or fun facts about them, but also little useful tips like that. Like here's how you prep an artichoke or here's how you're going to prep your mango or, you know, pick a fig when it's really heavy for its size. You know, those kind of little things that maybe some people instinctively know or you're taught and other people are just like, I don't even know what I'm looking for when I go to the market, you know?
So the book is filled with illustrations, sassy drawings, great art, but also lots of fun facts that I had no idea about. So for instance, I had no idea that, well, let's start talking about the avocado, that every single Haas avocado can be traced to one single tree here in Southern California. What's the story?
Yeah, I know. And how crazy is that? So in La Habra, I mean, that poor tree, it was the mother tree. It passed away in 2002. But like when I found that out, I was thinking, wait, like every avocado, you know, of the, some people say Haas, some people say Haas. I haven't talked to that family. I don't know, but I think it's Haas. But that every tree, you know, avocado can be traced to that tree. That's so crazy. And he was just a postal worker. Like it wasn't even, you know, an avocado farmer.
Mr. Haas or Haas?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah, he was a postal worker and then he patented that in 1935. And then that became, that kind of like knocked the Fuerte avocado out because it was creamier. It was more durable for shipping because it has that thicker, you know, pebbly skin. It had a longer growing season. So like when I read those kind of things, I'm thinking, man, I feel like everybody needs to know that story, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So then like those things, I'm like, okay, that makes it in the book for sure.
For sure. So why does that pebbly skin, why is that the one that takes over the Haas or Haas?
Because that's more durable in shipping. Like if you see a Fuerte, it's, you know, it's a thinner.
It's the smooth skin, the greeny smooth skin. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's so many things like with fruits where I feel like, and you know, produce in general, where I feel like the thing that's just going to hold up better in shipping, like it might not be the tastiest thing, but that's the thing that just becomes the most common because, hey, they can ship it. It lasts longer on the shelf. You know, I mean, there's so many fruits, especially here in California, like say like loquats, like those are not in my book, but just for instance, like you never see those at the store, but like there's trees all down my street that are loquats.
Yeah.
So it's like some things just don't hold up, you know, with the whole package, like packing and shipping and all that.
Okay, let's talk about the marshmallow. That thing, that just blew my mind because here I was thinking that this was just some kind of biochemical experiment, but it is, its history goes back a couple of thousand years. Can you give us a little primer on the marshmallow?
Yeah, well, so the marshmallow, like, you know, that name, for instance, like it just sounds fun. It sounds squishy. It sounds like it describes it, right? But the actual mallow plant grew in marshes. So that's where that name comes from. Like it's from a plant. So like that kind of thing, you know, like when I just read that, or maybe I can't remember where I first got interested in that, but it's like, you know, you see something or I'll hear a podcast and somebody will like mention something like that about the name, like, oh yeah, it's named after a plant. And then it's kind of like, wait, excuse me. And then I become like this food detective. And then I'm like on the internet and I'm watching videos and all this stuff. And then it's like, yeah, it's this ancient thing, like ancient Egyptians, they mixed the mallow sap with honey. And it was like this food only for the gods. And they used it for all sorts of things from, you know, like a love potion to cure sore throats and coughs, that kind of thing. And it's like, that was the original, you know, marshmallow type thing. But then once it got into French candy stores, they replaced the mallow sap with gelatin. And then it became, you know, more like the modern marshmallow we know now, which doesn't contain any mallow sap. But like that whole story is so interesting. So it's like, I don't know. I feel like once you hear something like that, you can't forget it. And then it changes your, like, you appreciate the marshmallow a little bit more, you know? And then I also threw something on that page that was about the Girl Scouts. Do you remember that part?
Yeah.
So like s'mores, right? It's like, you know, we all know that, but that was the first published recipe that used marshmallows. It was like in the 20s.
So Girl Scouts came up with that.
Yeah.
And they called it a s'more.
Yeah. They called it some more. And then, yeah, it was that morphed into s'mores.
Let's talk about liquid smoke because, again, like the marshmallow, I thought it was just a bunch of noxious chemicals created by a corporation to imitate the smell and taste of smoke. But in fact, it actually is smoke.
It is.
How is it created? How do you bottle smoke?
Well, okay, so that one, so just a fun little story about the book that I think is cool is a lot of people have, when I started posting these on Instagram, like originally before it was a book idea, a lot of people were like, can you do this? Can you explore this? Can you, you know, be a food detective on this one? And liquid smoke was one that a couple people were like, can you tell me what that is? Because like you said, it's like people don't really know what it is or how it's made. And everybody thinks it's just a chemical thing, you know, but it's actually real smoke that's made from condensation. So it's like wood chips, sawdust that's burned inside a chamber. And then that smoke rises and then it's captured. And then when it cools, all these little water droplets form. So it's like it's a collection basically of the condensation, and then it's filtered and concentrated and then bottled. So it's nothing crazy. It's actually just what it says, liquid smoke.
So what would you put it on if you used it? I've never used it.
Oh, well, I have a bottle that's probably way past its expiration, but it's still totally good. But but it flavors anything you want to taste. Like maybe you've cooked greens, like a pot of greens with something, like, you know, give it that smoky taste. Like if you would use a piece of ham, like, so a lot of vegetarians use it for stuff like that. But also just in barbecue sauce, like it's in barbecue sauce as an ingredient. And then the majority of liquid smoke that's used is actually the stuff that's in all the processed meats that you buy. So in hot dogs and lunch meats and bacon and cheese, like a lot of those things, those labels also, like I was super shocked to find out that if it just labels an ingredient as smoke, that could be, it's actually smoked in a smoker, or it could be liquid smoke. Like there's not really a,
really
anything that says, yeah. So it's kind of murky, like that definition of like when you just see smoked, blah, blah, blah.
So he's like a hickory smoked bacon is maybe just bacon with liquid smoke.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? Yeah. So then like also when you just add, like, it's also kind of one of those things that can totally transform your dish. So like a lot of times if I'm making a pot of beans or greens or something like that, like I'll just do one or two little drops and all of a sudden it's just like, holy cow, like, why is this so good? And it's like that magic bottle that's been sitting in the back of your cupboard forever.
Huh. I do have a question about the illustration.
Okay.
So on one of the hands that's holding the bottle of liquid smoke in your illustration, there's some writing on the hand. It says, pick up onions, call mom, laundry. So it was like a list of to-do things written on the hand.
Yeah, that was really on my hand that day when I made that, when I made that page.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I always write on my hand. I'm like, you know, like 13. But I always write on my hands like little things. And I feel like, you know, all these pages were just ways that I can, you know, just tell stories and whatever. So I thought like, you know, I'm going to hide that really small. Like I'm surprised that you saw that, but it's like, you know, it's really faint on there, but just writing those couple little like notes, then also like, I'm sure my mom will be like, oh my God, you were thinking of me, you know, so I'll get points with my mom. It'll be great. But also just, it's fun to like all through this book, you know, there's little things that I hid, little messages, like, you know, people call them Easter eggs. But like, mm-hmm. I put those all over the book, and it's just, I think it's fun because you can't, you know, it's like, you'll maybe notice it on the second or the third, you know, pass when you're looking at something, or yeah, I don't know. And I'm the hand model in almost all of these drawings also. So yeah.
Okay. You do it all. You are a one woman band.
Exactly.
Well, check out Stacy's new book. It's called Eat This Book, Knowledge to Feed Your Appetite and Inspire Your Next Meal. Stacy Michelson, thank you.
That was the best. Thank you, Madeline Brand.
coming up, the ArcLight movie houses could not survive the pandemic. They are shutting down for good.
This includes the iconic Cinerama Dome in Hollywood on Sunset Boulevard. That theater has been around for nearly 60 years, and it is one of the highest grossing theaters in the country.
We'll have that story next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, the pandemic has cost us a lot, but the hope that someday post-vaccine we would return to our favorite places, that hope has carried us through the hardest parts of these last 13 months. Well, news came this week that the iconic ArcLight Cinema and 58-year-old Cinerama Dome in Hollywood would not be reopening post-pandemic. In fact, the owners of ArcLight Cinemas and Pacific Theater said none of their locations would be reopening post-COVID. That's right, no more ArcLight caramel corn or movie pour-sized glasses of wine. Joining me to remember these theaters, particularly the iconic Hollywood location, is Christy Lemire. She writes for RogerEbert.com and co-hosts the podcast Breakfast All Day, and she's our regular, one of our regular and most beloved film critics on Fridays. Hi, Christy.
Hello, my friend. What a sad day it is.
I know. And we have all spent so many glorious hours at the ArcLights, especially the one in Hollywood. Talk about it.
So many.
Yeah, from your perspective.
So it's funny, when you're a film critic, especially if you're a freelancer, like so many of us are, like, you don't have an office. Right? You watch movies at your house or you write at your house. And so going to the ArcLight on a Monday night to see a big studio release and all your fellow critics are there and there's a buzz in the audience, there's people who love film. You know, it's like going to your favorite office, but also your favorite watering hole. And there's such a great energy the minute you walk into that lobby with just the giant soaring ceilings and the huge marquee with all the times and the big clock. And you felt like you were walking into a cathedral of sorts. And yet there's also a very intimate sense of community because you could go and have a bite to eat beforehand or have a glass of wine afterward and talk about what you had just seen. You go get a cup of coffee and go peruse the books. They always had a great, really cool rotating exhibit of different costumes and props, various movies. One of my favorites was one of the really sparkly skating dresses that Margot Robbie wore in I, Tonya. They had really cool art on the walls. I mean, it just, it was a place unlike any other, but also, you know, you went to see movies and the ArcLight completely raised your expectations as to how you should experience a film. I mean, it was a very new thing to be able to pick out your own seat in the theater. And, you know, you find after time that you liked a certain spot more than any other. Like my friends and I always sat in the back right. And that was our spot.
And you know what? I really appreciate the guys who come on and gals, men and women who came on before to give you the little pep talk before the movie started.
Right. They would explain like, hi, my name is so-and-so. You're going to be watching A Quiet Place. It's an hour and 47 minutes, or directed by John Krasinski, or whatever movie it was.
Right, and they also let their personalities flow a little bit, which I liked. And then they also sort of indicated that they were here to make sure you had a great experience. So I don't know if anyone ever went and got them if something was happening that was bad, but knowing that they
were there. I did once. The one rare time that like the projection did not work, there were people standing right outside the door as they promised they will be. And it was like one other guy in the theater and me. But literally in hundreds of experiences of the ArcLight, that was the only time. And then they were indeed there. And then I got a refund. So they do what they say they're going to do. But yeah, those little speeches give you a sense that you are among folks, you know, from every level of the experience who love film and who care about you seeing it the way it's meant to be seen and hearing the sound the way it's meant to be heard. And that is not something that takes place everywhere.
Yeah. So what about the dome, the Cinerama Dome itself? Iconic as an LA image and an institution, it is one of the few concrete geodesic domes on the planet. What is going to happen to that?
Yeah. Thing? So I can't imagine that they're going to tear down
the Cinerama Dome and make it into like a mixed use, like apartment complex slash Whole Foods. I cannot imagine that that's going to happen.
Let's hope not. Yeah.
Right. It's just depressing to even think about, but like it's got cultural historical landmark protection within Los Angeles. So I think it's going to be okay. Yeah. But I really hope that the same happens for, you know, that Hollywood ArcLight, but also like all those locations and all the Pacific theaters too, which we talk about the ArcLight a lot, but at least once a week, I was at the movies at the Grove because a lot of screenings take place at the Grove too. And those are important hubs for both the Grove and the Americana, those big movie theaters. You know, you go have dinner and go see a movie or go buy a sweater you don't need or whatever it is. It's depressing. And it's just right as other theater chains are ramping up to begin reopening, and smaller chains like the Alamo Drafthouse could, you know, claim Chapter 11 bankruptcy and still stay afloat. So I don't know what's going on with this, but it was very sudden.
I know it does raise a lot of questions because it seemed like they were doing well pre-pandemic. I mean,
totally gangbusters business. And we're right into whatever kind of summer blockbuster season we might have. I think they were hoping to reopen, when I'm reading from this Deadline story, that they were hoping to reopen on Memorial Day weekend with A Quiet Place 2 and Cruella. And A Quiet Place is absolutely the kind of movie you want to see in a giant 400 person auditorium like the ArcLight. You want to experience the communal tension and the silence. I recall seeing the first A Quiet Place there. You could hear a pin drop in a completely packed theater. And so that experience is just, it's hard to replicate. And I just hope that there's so much love, you know, so much fervor for this place. You look on Twitter and filmmakers as disparate as like Gina Prince-Bythewood and Lulu Wong and Edward Wright and Ryan Johnson. And everyone has, you know, stories to tell about how much they love this place. There's got to be some kind of like consortium of wealthy people that can swoop in and fix this, right?
In this town, perhaps.
You think?
A few.
It's safe. It is a sacred place. So I'm still hopeful. I'm trying not to get too sad.
Do you remember your first Cinerama Dome movie?
Do I remember my first one? So one thing I took Nick to spend, and I sent Nick, who is now 11, who you've met. I've taken him to see Infinity War there. And that was really cool. I got to do a lot of Q&As as a moderator at the ArcLight and the Cinerama Dome. One thing that was really cool was seeing Free Solo at the Dome and then interviewing Alex Honnold afterward. And he was mobbed like a rock star. And, you know, like trying to like a beetle trying to flee the masses. Actually, no, he was really cool.
He could have climbed up the sides.
Right? He probably could have climbed the dome. What a missed opportunity, right? That's your photo op right there. Yeah. Alex Honnold, like a walk in the park, climbing up the Cinerama Dome. But things like that, you know, it's just, it's unlike any place else. But also, like a few years ago, they had a restored print of 2001, A Space Odyssey, that they were showing at both the Dome.
Another perfect place to see that movie. Yeah.
Totally. And we took our son, who was then 8 years old, to like a 9 o'clock in the morning showing on a Sunday of 2001, A Space Odyssey. And that's just the kind of place where you want to have that kind of experience. Yeah. And so... what about you? What was your first Dome movie?
My first was T2, Terminator 2. And so I know we're out of time, unfortunately. Otherwise, I would go way down memory lane. But maybe Arnold will be back and save the Dome. How about that?
Right. Maybe it'll be like the T-1000 and you can't keep it down.
Christy LaMira writes at RogerEbert.com, co-hosts the podcast Breakfast All Day. Thank you, Christy.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk about a new documentary with the filmmaker. It's called Collective. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Back in 2015, concertgoers in Romania were rocking out in a nightclub. A heavy metal band called Goodbye to Gravity was on stage. The liquor was flowing, the music blaring. Then someone set off some pyrotechnics, some fireworks, and a fire quickly spread in the club. It had no emergency exits. 27 people died that night. In the months that followed, the death toll rose to 64. But those patients who were in the hospital weren't suffering from life-threatening burns at the time, so it was a mystery as to why they had died. A team of journalists uncovered the reason and in the process revealed massive corruption in the Romanian healthcare system. Their story is told in a gripping documentary called Collective, now up for a couple of Academy Awards, Best Documentary and Best International Film. Director Alexander Nanau joins us now from Bucharest. Welcome to the program and congratulations.
Thank you very much and thank you for having me, Madeline.
Oh, it's great to have you. And your film is absolutely incredible. It's riveting to watch. Originally, there were mass protests after this fire because it was revealed that there was all this corruption involving this particular incident. But your film isn't about that particular scandal, about the fire itself and what happened. It follows the aftermath. How did you begin shooting this documentary and doing your research?
Oh, I was basically triggered by what this fire started in the Romanian society, because within one night in several cities, a young generation took the streets protesting against a populistic, corrupt and incompetent political class that, as they said, can treat these burned patients and they need no help from other countries. Which was insane. There were over 180 burn patients and Romania did not have any capacity to treat severe burn patients. And people started dying in hospitals. And I wanted to make basically a film about power. I wanted to understand power and who these people are that are capable of doing something like that, like health officials, politicians and doctors lying to these parents and saying that they cannot transfer their kids to proper burn units to other countries around Romania. But as I had no access to power, because it was a very non-transparent power, we figured that the best way would be to shadow the work of investigative journalists that are investigating the healthcare system and the whole power, basically.
Why did the authorities and the doctors refuse to transfer the patients to other hospitals, because they could have been transferred to Germany, for example, and received excellent care?
Right, which much too late they were transferred because so many people died that they got scared. But it's hard to say how much we can, you know, say that it was because of corruption or because of incompetence. So I'm sure, as you can also see in the film, when the whistleblowers come in and show that the healthcare system started to spend huge amounts of money because of this crisis, we can assume that they wanted to spend the money in their own pockets. But we can also assume that there was also something like, trying to cover how incompetent the healthcare system was.
Right, to try to cover up how bad the system was and had been for many, many years. And it had been underfunded, under-resourced. Thousands of doctors and nurses have left the country because they can't function in this healthcare system. So you decided to follow this team of journalists. And one item that's really remarkable in this is that these journalists work for a sports newspaper. How did a sports newspaper come to investigate this and become such intrepid investigative reporters?
I mean, they were investigative reporters before. They did investigations for 25 years and also very successfully, but their investigations even brought down to sports ministers that had to go to jail and also the big soccer bosses in the country. So they were well known and feared for sure, mm-hmm, by politicians, but the majority of the press just failed after the fire. They did not ask the right questions and only propagated the lies that the authorities were telling in a systematic way. So whistleblowers, or the first one, the woman that blew the whistle from inside the system, the doctor, went to them. And I think it was, because it was such a national tragedy, it was almost a moral obligation that they took on to use their skills and investigate now the healthcare system.
It's interesting that they were also the subject of protest, but in a good way, I suppose. Let's hear a clip from your movie. So basically saying the best investigations are being made by a sports daily. That is the state of our press. So the state of the press in Romania is pretty anemic.
Let's say that it's different now because the disinvestigations changed a lot and changed also the relationship of the citizens to the press and the trust they have in the press. But, you know, at that time, the problem was that it was a deep professionalized press that had no real healthcare journalists. And, you know, if you don't know enough about healthcare, you can't really tell when the authorities are lying.
So they do some dogged investigative reporting, and they were okay with you following along with your camera?
Not at first. When we approached them, you know, they were polite, but not open. They said, listen, and I proposed if they could imagine to let me shadow their work if they continue to investigate the healthcare system and what is happening in hospitals with the burn patients. And they said, listen, the newsroom has to stay protected. We have to protect whistleblowers. We have to protect information and our colleagues. But they also thought that our own development team of the film, which was also an investigative team, that we also had very good information and we investigated everything very thoroughly and had our own sources inside the system. And I think that gave them also trust in our work and in the professional way we approached the intention to make a film about this. And after a while, the lead journalist, Catherine Tonantan, called me and said, listen, we are onto something. We can't tell you what it is, but we can try. Let's try to see how it works if you try to film our work on this investigation. But they would not tell me what it is. So I had to put the puzzle pieces together while I was shooting observationally with them.
Hmm. And so your movie is really two narratives, in a sense. It's about what you just said about the journalism part, but also about the investigation and what was happening inside those hospitals. And the movie you reveal, and the movie and the journalists you cover reveal, that the hospital that was treating the burn victims was using diluted disinfectants.
Right.
On the operating tools. Yeah.
Right. That was the next step. So after they found out that most of the burn patients died by hospital infections and not their burn injuries, the investigation went further and they found out that a company that was producing disinfectants for almost all state hospitals was diluting them. They were doing that for almost 10 years and it was known by the Secret Service and by the healthcare officials and the politicians. So there are more people implied than only the private company. That's the problem.
Right. And so then the health minister resigns and a new guy comes in, a former patient advocate, a young man named Vlad Voiculescu. Mm-hmm. And he becomes a central character in the movie. Tell us about him.
Right. So after the investigation brought down the minister that tried to cover up this company, the system basically named somebody who was independent, who was from outside the political system and the healthcare system. He was basically living in Austria, working in a bank, and he was a patient's activist. So he was known, and I had heard of him because he built up something like a network of people that would bring cancer medicine into Romania from the West that was missing for cancer patients. Something like the Dallas Buyers Club, you could compare it to that. And I saw that as my chance to go back to the initial idea to make a film about power and to really get inside the power structure and see how it operates. And he was open. He was basically, he and his very young team, and they said, listen, one of our main goals now is to bring transparency to this ministry because health is a basic right. It is written in our constitution and people have all the right to know what decisions we are taking here inside and upon which criteria. So he risked that to let me film inside the ministry and let me film their procedures, basically. And he said, you know, everybody will hate us for that. everybody in this ministry will never understand how a minister could ever give access to a filmmaker inside the ministry. But I think that his courage is equal to the courage of the whistleblowers that there is so much and of the journalists.
Yeah, because he has to go up against the whole system from within the system, and it's his job that's on the line and more.
I learned something during this project, and it is that in any political system or a healthcare system, it has a protection mechanism. Basically, every member of it is controlled by the other members by some vulnerabilities. Everybody has some vulnerabilities. And somebody who is inside a system and part of the system would risk his career if he or she would give, you know, access to somebody or be transparent, because it could put in danger any one of the other members, right? So the fact that he didn't owe anybody anything because he was from outside the system made it possible for him to say, I don't care. Let's be transparent.
He's the health minister now, correct?
Yeah, because things have changed a bit since then, and people started to vote differently. New parties, new reformatory parties were formed by people that came out of private businesses and understood that you cannot change society if you don't get involved into politics. And in the last elections last year, they won enough votes in order to really win over major mayors, major cities. And since last Christmas, Vlad is basically again Minister of Health, because this new party has got enough votes in order to be part of a coalition government.
So he's back in power, and now there's another problem, and that's the COVID epidemic. How is he handling that?
The COVID thing in Romania is handled by a military commando, so to say. They took it out of the hands of the ministry, and it's a very good excuse. If you lead with the military, you can always say that it's a state secret and you can't be too transparent. But he's fighting for transparency, and he had already several scandals where he and his team would release open data about vaccines and the way the country is testing. And journalists, because of this open data they published, could find out that, for example, there were more secret vaccine stations for the politicians and their families than for the population. And because journalists, together with this data, basically unveiled that, they were forced to open up all stations for the whole population, and vaccination goes pretty well right now. So they are already vaccinating, you know, the broad population.
So, I mean, even though your movie is pretty grim and on many levels, it does have that flicker of hope. And, you know, it ends before this time period that we're talking about now. But I think what you're trying to say in the movie is that for democracy to work, or for systems to work for the people, you have to remain vigilant, and you have to have a group of people who are willing to fight and fight hard against a system that can overwhelm them.
I think that it's a story that shows how democracy works, basically, and how a collaboration and trust between citizens and a professional press can really help a society to evolve. And whenever there is truth, a society can evolve. And that's what you can see in the film, and the fact that you see people standing up to their values. And they are successful, right? The investigations you see in the film are successful. And that really changed the course of the Romanian society, because we can see now that the trust in the press is different. We can see now that people are much more vigilant and understand basically how the system works. So this incident and the investigations are basically a point of awakening, I would say. That's what is also so satisfactory for us, that this film is remaining as a reminder for that point, even for the next generations.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's Alexander Nanau. He's the director of the Oscar-nominated documentary Collective. It's streaming now on Hulu and available on video on demand. And that does it for us today on Press Play. Thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.